Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association. The MMA is providing the platform for the administration, for Lieutenant Governor Polito and members of the administration to provide a weekly briefing for municipal chief executive officers. This briefing will go on for 1 hour. We will end promptly at 2 o'clock because the governor and lieutenant governor will be making their daily press statement and announcements at that time. And the lieutenant governor will need to depart this meeting at 1:45 in order to be at the briefing in the state house. The meeting will start with the lieutenant governor, and then we will have brief updates from agencies. And then there will be an opportunity for questions and answers via the chat forum, which I will moderate as we go on. So at this time, I'd like to express a deep appreciation of local officials all across the state for the leadership of Lieutenant Governor Polito and Governor Baker during this crisis, and turn the program over to you, Lieutenant Governor, for your opening comments.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, for hosting us this week by video. So really good that we can see some of you. I am here, obviously, with Sean Cronin. As you can see, we're up at the State House in our fourth floor office where we usually hold our cabinet and group meetings. Haven't been doing that so much. This is as close as we're getting to people in the way things are. So. Thank you very much for your time. I'm just going to give you a few updates, and then we're going to turn it over to those who are going to give you some further details in the agency areas that Jeff outlined. And then I'd like to really hear the pressing issues that are on your mind of the top concerns. First of all, there is a number of actions either taken or proposed and are pending before the legislature regarding our municipalities, whether it's workforce or finance or permitting issues or dates or deadlines like elections. I'm not going to get into those because I think we've gone over a lot of that, and that information you probably have. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but I'm happy to later if there are further questions. Also an update for municipal and school administrators. There is a free remote working kit for 90 days, and it's by LogMeIn, which provides this technology and capacity to you. So if you need more information on that, we can get that out to you as well, just making sure that technology is available to you so that you can have your meetings and interactions as needed in a safe manner. Let me just give you some areas that I'd like to cover. First, on medical staff, I do hear from a lot of you regarding both two things. One, personal protective equipment, and seeing that this equipment is available to you and your frontline staff, and also regarding people. Like, who are the people that we're recruiting to add redundancy to the frontline, doctors, nurses, and PAs. This week, we were able to work with our deans of medical schools, asking medical school graduates to come forward. They will be licensed for a 90-day period to be able to help us fight the epidemic. We've also recruited a number of medical professionals in good standing to come back in to service to help us bring more frontline capacity in this effort. We've been able to marshal over 1,800 people through this effort. On PPE, a couple of things. We have started an online portal, which is where individuals and companies can donate or contract with the state to supply PPE. This online portal is seen at the COVID website. So you may be hearing from people that have these offerings, and we need them to go through this portal so that we can inventory and get in touch with all of these people. We've also been able to hear from a number of business owners that want to transition into the manufacturing and making of these materials here in the Commonwealth, which is also part of that portal system that you can convey that information to us. You've obviously heard us talk almost daily about the strategic national stockpile of PPE and some frustration that we are having here in the Commonwealth, you know, submitting our orders and wanting those orders to be delivered. Some good news over the weekend, we made requests to the federal government for ventilators, and 1,000 ventilators have been approved. We should be receiving these soon. And we also did receive through the stockpile 28,000 masks, 120,000 pairs of gloves, and we've been able to place more orders for these supplies. We have a number of private individuals that are also trying to do their part to secure this PPE for your frontline as well as our hospital frontline as well. School and early education, you are up to speed that that is in place, those closures through May 4th. WGBH has been a critical partner to provide online learning opportunities, especially to reach students that don't have technology to access programs that their school district might be offering. On grocery stores, the Department of Public Health issued a new public health order relative to grocery stores and pharmacies, aiming to ensure social distance and proper sanitation, and then adding in the 1 hour per day for adults over 60, the lot of sanitation options, the self-serve food stations closed down, the usable bags as opposed to using plastic bags as opposed to reusable bags, and stores not charging for bags at this time. We ask you to just be up to date with these orders, and the Board of Health, you have a lot on your plates, but we view our groceries and our pharmacies as critical. We need to make sure that people can access these resources in a safe manner, and also have the workforce at these locations safe in the process of doing their jobs. FEMA disaster relief was declared for Massachusetts, which was great. And the disaster declaration request included a request for obviously the public assistance program through FEMA, which Sam can discuss a little bit more with you when she's up. The tax deadline for individual filers extended to July 15th. The legislature is working with us on finances associated with that in order to budget the resources needed with and for all of you. Testing, you can see that we have put a program in place to rapidly and extensively increase the amount of testing, so we know who is infected and how they can get treatment. And also we'll be sharing with you a tracing program that will complement the testing program that will be extensive as well. And you will be hearing more about that in the days to come. Total over 40,000 tests conducted, 21 lab sites available, and obviously prioritizing testing for emergency responders as part of this effort. Today at 2 o'clock, we will be making a series of announcements about the extension of the order regarding essential services. We will be discussing that and releasing information about what is essential following the federal government's update to their essential critical industry list that was released over the weekend. So we ask that you listen to our announcements then, and of course we can continue to be available to answer any questions that you have through Jeff's office, that then those questions are shared with us so that we can get a good response back to you. So with that, I am now turning it over to Sam for her update. Thank you, Sam.
call. I'm going to just say a few brief remarks that will, I hope, capture some of the questions that we've received ahead of time. So thank you for sharing those. I'll start first with information around the disaster declaration that the Lieutenant Governor was talking about. So states around the country received early on what's called an emergency declaration. That was then followed up on Saturday with a presidential disaster dec, a major disaster dec. And that means that up to that the federal government will support up to 75% of eligible expenses. All of this information is right on MEMA's homepage. So there's a COVID homepage that has great information around public health information. But just on our landing page, there's a box right in the middle of the screen that has information on cost eligibility and tracking those costs. We have also done outreach to all of our local stakeholders. We've done some webinars, and we will continue to do that. But this is a very similar program to what's used during snowstorms and coastal storms. So we hope that many of your colleagues at the local level are familiar with how to track these costs, but we are standing by with our disaster recovery team ready to walk through this process. But I'll just speak give a quick overview on what are some eligible categories of work, and then we can certainly get into the details or connect you with somebody here to kind of help with this. So under the disaster declaration, everything related to the management, control, and reduction of immediate threats to public health and safety. So that includes activating and operating emergency operations centers, training, including, you know, training on how to properly wear personal protective equipment or operate medical shelters, work regarding disinfecting public facilities, and any kind of technical assistance that you may have, that local governments may be interested in procuring related to emergency management or control of immediate threats to public safety. So for example, if you've maybe hired a vendor or increased some of your staffing capacity at the local level related to managing this crisis, those are eligible expenses. The second bucket is around emergency medical care. So, you know, supporting facilities and supplies, standing up temporary medical facilities or enhancing existing medical or hospital capacity, the use of special medical equipment, medical waste disposal, and emergency medical transport. So those are the categories in emergency medical care. And then medical sheltering. So this would include standing up both congregate care sites and non-congregate care sites. And I want to talk, when I'm finished, I'll talk a little bit more about the non-congregate care sites. Sheltering, movement of supplies in person. So if you're, if you're in doing a warehouse operation or a logistics operation, those things are eligible, including security and law enforcement and communications. So there's a lot in this bucket that's all eligible through Category B of the Public Assistance Program. So that's all emergency protective measures. And then I just want to talk about two other programs. So as part of this, MEMA applied through the federal government for eligibility to do non-congregate sheltering. And so normally in disasters, when you set up shelters, for example, or evacuation centers, those are all eligible expenses. You have to get specific permission ahead of time if you wanted to leverage things like hotels or dormitory spaces. We have received that approval that those are now eligible expenses. And that is not only for state government, but also for our local partners. So if local communities want to house first responders who may be needing quarantine in a hotel, that is an eligible expense. So I'll just go through the three buckets of eligibility around non-congregate housing. First responders and healthcare workers who need to quarantine safely without exposing their families. The second bucket is homeless families with at least one member who has tested positive for COVID-19 who live in congregate shelters and will require isolation. And the third bucket is homeless individuals who require quarantine or isolation. And again, all of this information is on MEMA's website. And we have technical assistance here to walk you through the process and help you get registered with the federal government to start your application. We've also heard from FEMA that they are going to be working diligently to do expedited payment. So as you submit costs, you know, typically after a disaster, we sort of do this huge reconciliation, kind of a post-mortem from a financial perspective. They're working to try to get payment back to communities and state government as quickly as possible, almost on a rolling basis, just recognizing some of the financial constraints of dealing with such a large-scale operation like this. The second bucket that I just want to talk about from a kind of business recovery, and there's a specific question about agriculture. So we did receive an economic injury disaster loan approval from the Small Business Administration. So these are low interest loans that go to businesses, and that does include agriculture as well. So if you have questions, you know, we can help with that and just, you know, make sure that you're helping to provide this information onto your private sector partners within your communities. The last thing I want to talk about is a little bit of an update on housing, and specifically on some of the things the state is doing, and then some of the things that we want to support you with at the local level. So the priority at the state right now is really trying to focus on individuals that need isolation. So again, there's kind of two buckets: quarantine or individuals who have not tested COVID positive, and then isolation would be those who have tested COVID positive. We're still looking at our capacity to support with quarantine individuals, just recognizing that that could be a very sizable number of individuals who may need some support with quarantine. But for starters, we're really focusing on that isolation population. So that could include individuals who are homeless and have been tested positive for COVID and, you know, have maybe been admitted to a hospital, but are well enough to now be released from a hospital. So we are building out a housing program where we are partnering, we are signing contracts with hotels and bringing in private security and arranging for cleaning and feeding and all of the wraparound services to provide a place for homeless individuals to continue to isolate without furthering exposing populations in congregate care. The other piece I want to mention is there was an email that went out to shelter providers with a due back of close of business today, walking through what some assistance is needed in order for them to best kind of care for their populations. That could either be trying to work with them to expand their current capacity, so whether we can do wraparound tents or other things so that individuals who are homeless have the ability to kind of get the social distancing that they need to keep safe in their shelters, and then, you know, put some other support services. That information will then come to MEMA, and we will work with homeless shelters very closely on whether it's procuring tents and working with, you know, a designer to kind of build out that space, providing some of the food and feeding operations, providing the contents that would go in those shelters, such as cots, linens, blankets, et cetera. So that did go out from the COVID command center over the weekend. And then, you know, we're standing ready to provide support to our colleagues who are working with individuals who are homeless. So I think I'll stop there. I tried to answer the couple of questions that were directed my way. And just a reminder, with the eligibility for non-congregate housing, individuals at the local level, cities and towns can stand up similar programs and receive the same 75-25 cost share. So you will only be responsible for 25% of the cost of those programs if you implement them at the local level as well. So I think at this point, I'm passing it to Dr. Larry Madoff.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Doctor.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on the call today. Thank you to MEMA. Thank you to the Lieutenant Governor. And on behalf of DPH, I want to thank all of you for your hard work on this ongoing outbreak and the challenges that it poses. I'm just going to try to address a couple of questions that have been asked by folks for this call, and also will be available for questions as they arise. As you know, we're facing increasing numbers of cases of COVID-19 here in Massachusetts. As of yesterday at this time, there were 5,752 laboratory confirmed cases of COVID in the state. And this number we expect to continue to grow. For some time to come, as the governor mentioned yesterday, the peak is not expected for at least 2 to 3 weeks. And we expect to see continuing increasing numbers of cases and sadly deaths associated with this outbreak. It's presenting challenges to all of us, to our healthcare facilities, our frontline healthcare workers, our emergency responders who are working literally around the clock on this problem. And some of the questions arise about how individuals and particularly how people who work for governmental agencies should respond to COVID. And you know, I think the time has come when most of us are going to know somebody or know of somebody who has had this illness. And it's not just going to be something we read about in the papers, but something that we're going to see in friends and family and loved ones around us. And I know that's causing great concern. I want to emphasize the important role that healthcare providers have in this conversation, and that I really want to encourage people who have questions about their own health, about their own exposures with COVID, to work with their healthcare provider, because these are people who are most knowledgeable about your individual health, existing underlying conditions that you may have a relationship with you, and know what resources are available to you. So I think it's really important that you turn to these people and certainly make telephone calls. I know they're busy. It may be hard to get in touch with somebody, but I really think that's the most important thing that an individual who has questions about themselves or people around them with COVID or symptoms of COVID do, to get reliable information. I would also urge all of you to work with your local boards of health that are in the best position to know what is going on in your community, to have up-to-date advice from the Department of Public Health, from the command center that's been stood up by the Secretary of EHS, and to be able to get in touch with the Department of Public Health easily and quickly. You also know that we're available to you through the Department of Public Health, and we do have a 24/7 hotline that's available where you'll get a response from an epidemiologist as quickly as we can. That telephone number is 617-983-6800. And again, that's available 24/7. One of the frequent questions that comes up is around testing and testing for COVID. And what the good news, I guess, if there's good news here, is that the availability of testing has increased dramatically since we last spoke. And at this point, while there are some shortages in supplies, some shortages in swabs, some shortages in PPE, testing, the availability of the test itself is pretty widespread. And so people who need to be tested, in discussion with their healthcare provider, can access testing pretty much throughout the state at this point. And I want to stress that while there are recommendations about who should be tested, this is available to healthcare providers, and healthcare providers can make that decision with their patients about who needs to be tested, and can get that testing done through various means, including drive-through clinics and other sites that are available for large-scale testing, and in individual provider offices and health centers and hospitals, emergency rooms, and other locations where testing is available. And we expect that availability of testing to continue to expand. As of yesterday, more than 50,000 tests have been run in Massachusetts residents, and that number is increasing daily, and the availability of testing is increasing daily. One question that frequently arises is about testing people who have been exposed or don't have symptoms, or just testing people who are asymptomatic, don't have fever, cough, or any other symptoms, and just want to get a test result. And I want to emphasize that we don't recommend that. This test has been mostly validated for symptomatic individuals, and that's really who testing is intended for. There are some limited circumstances where we're testing asymptomatic individuals, but that's very specific situations. And by and large, people who think they might have had an exposure or don't know if they've had an exposure or just worried are counseled not to get tested. And that's because it's very difficult to interpret a test in an asymptomatic individual. There's a variable period of time after an exposure that a person can develop symptoms and get positive. And so having a negative test right now doesn't really mean that you won't, that test won't turn positive the next day or even the next hour. And so having a negative test could be just kind of falsely reassuring that there hasn't been an exposure. And so we are using the quarantine guidelines of 14 days based on the amount of time that it can take to develop symptoms after an exposure to someone with disease. And the presence of a positive test in an individual who doesn't have symptoms also, we don't really know how to interpret. We know that many of those people will not go on to get disease and probably don't pose much risk to those around them. While it's certainly possible that asymptomatic individuals can spread disease, and that's something we're becoming increasingly aware of, we still think that the major drivers of the outbreak are people who are sick, who have cough and sneezes that we know spread respiratory droplets around. So I think I've tried to address some of the questions that were asked of us ahead of time, and I know there may be more questions going forward, but I'll turn it back to the moderator at this point, and please stay in touch with us. And thank you very much for all of the hard work that you're doing.
So good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to touch on the legislation that the Lieutenant Governor talked about, just to give a quick update, because there has been some activity on the bills, and then I'll close with answering a couple questions that came in advance. So the bills that came out, House Ways and Means Committee and Senate Ways and Means Committee late last week, early this week, include all these following municipal finance-related items, which are all very, very helpful. Allow the delay of town meetings beyond June 30th. Allow the moderator to continue a town meeting for public health reasons. Allow the month-to-month budget process with DLS in fiscal 21 if a budget's not approved by June 30th. Will allow municipalities to appropriate its free cash, any leftover free cash as of 7/1/19 after June 30th, prior to free cash being certified again. If it's because of a delayed town meeting, that's both cities and towns, at least in this most recent version of the bill. It will allow the amortization of any FY20 coronavirus deficit related related deficit over 3 years, that local option, revolving fund cap, whatever you had in the current year would carry forward in 21. Would extend time provisions related to municipal right of first refusal for chapter land. That would allow municipalities to extend the property tax due date to no later than June 1st and extend the date for exemption applications also to no later than June 1st. It will allow municipalities to waive the payment of interest and other penalties for late payment of any excise tax, betterment, water, or sewer charge. And I just note here that the Senate Ways and Means language that came out yesterday did include some language about municipalities not being able to terminate essential services. And the House version that came out after that did not include that. So we'll see where that lands. The bottom line is in both versions, you'll be able to waive any and all late fees. It suspends the cap on hours of compensation for retirees, so you'd be able to bring back those employees to help with the workforce. And then just a couple of other items that were included in both versions of the bill. The allowance for beer and wine as part of restaurant takeout, and the local permitting process, the modifications to that, which MMA has played a leading role in drafting language, and that language is really continuing forward in the most recent version of the bill. And the last two things I'll speak to are two of the questions that Jeff sent in advance. One of them was the potential impact on state aid, and will there be changes to consensus revenue? I think folks are aware that next week, Secretary A&F will be having discussions with the chairs of both House Ways and Means and Senate Ways and Means on this exact topic. So there'll be more to come after that. And then there was another question, whether legislation will be filed to allow select boards via unanimous vote to access their stabilization fund, with approval from DLS, that are required to continue to fund essential public safety services. That is definitely something that we've been discussing internally at DLS, along with a couple of other things such as year-end transfers. If town meeting can't meet, can the Board of Selectmen and Finance Committee take votes on those? Same thing with stabilization funds, same thing with free cash. So those are things that we're currently thinking about internally. And if you have any other thoughts and ideas around whether it be year-end processes. We just saw the questions that came up. Yes, the permitting language, my understanding is the exact language that was in the governor's bill and then followed into the House Ways and Means version. So that has carried forward. So I'll stop there. And if there are any other finance-related questions, I can speak to those. And if there's anything on the permitting, I know that Elizabeth Dennison will be able to speak to those as well.
Thank you very much, Sean, and for all of your work on all of these complex issues. Are there any other agency updates before we proceed with questions?
Do we want EOS to just give a minute or two overview of to log me in?
Yes, I will unmute Kathy and Matthew from the Executive Office of Technology Services and Security, and they will provide an update on the Lieutenant Governor's announcement regarding remote tools for schools for the remainder of the year. They are being unmuted now.
Thanks, Jeff. This is Matt Moran from the Executive Office of Technology, Services, and Security. As the Lieutenant Governor mentioned from the opening about an hour ago, Kathy Marks from our Office of School and Municipal Technology sent out an email blast to all of you, providing you with an opportunity to access some virtual online collaboration tools. The company known as LogMeIn contacted the administration to offer up their tools and assistance to communities who might be struggling to keep municipal business moving in this telework environment. So we collaborated with them to put this offering together, and they're calling it a 90-day toolkit. Essentially what that is a series of their offerings. You might know GoToMeeting, which is more of like an office, person-to-person, team-to-team collaborative tool. and then GoToWebinar, which you can escalate up to about 3,000 users, and then some remote desktop work and some other features. What's contained in our email message is directions on how to avail yourself of all these tools. There's a link to a landing page that we worked to make Massachusetts specific so that communities could go on, access the tools by basically filling out a request form. And then the folks from LogMeIn will follow that up, contact you sort of one-on-one. They'll be able to evaluate what your needs are, and you can kind of put together the best package for you. You might not need anything. You might need one or two things. They'll work with you to figure out how many licenses and how many users you need and put something together. Again, it's free. There are no conditions after the 90-day window, and they have tech support that will help work through some things for you. And they've also offered up some useful webinars if you need help sort of figuring out how to use the tools. And Kathy, I don't know if I missed anything or if you want to underscore anything that I just highlighted.
No, I think you covered it. The only thing I want to add is that, you know, this is the 90-day and it's free. There are no credit cards required to sign up. So there is no billing information that will be gathered for this 90 days. So feel free to contact them. If you did not get the email blast, we are also sending out an alert through the DLS alert system. So you should be getting it from them shortly as well.
I saw one question, Jeff, I don't know how you want to handle these, but I saw one just pop up. Is consideration being given to allow for capital expenditures under the 112 scenario? The answer is, if that's really part of your operating budget, that you're funding police cruises or whatever the capital outlay might be, the answer is yes. I mean, we'll work with you on that.
Thank you. Just a few items in terms of some questions that had come in. We will do again what we did previously, which was to forward all of the questions, both asked, answered and unanswered. And then the administration will get back responses that are available, and we will push those out to all of the participants here in the meeting and to the MMA membership in general. So we thank, first of all of your agencies for being so responsive, Lieutenant Governor, and providing answers, even if we can't get to all of them right now. There are a couple of questions that have been burning, and one is regarding the, and Dr. Madoff covered this a little bit in your comments. I'll unmute you now, Dr. Madoff, and that is regarding essential municipal personnel. If they are exposed, can you again, if they have a potential exposure to the virus, but they have not developed symptoms, can you develop or talk about what the protocol you recommend be followed regarding either self-quarantining or isolation, because there's such a concern about the loss of a critical number, an adequate number of first responders and essential personnel.
So thanks for that question, and it's a good and important and difficult question. First of all, we do have specific guidance with regard to healthcare workers, and we would certainly include emergency medical personnel in that category of people who are healthcare workers. And for those individuals, we are allowing asymptomatic but exposed individuals to return to work, requiring them to carefully monitor themselves for symptoms, for fever, and to wear a surgical mask, a protective mask, during a 14-day interval from the last exposure. I will need to get back to you with regard to other types of first responders and essential personnel on that point.
Thank you very much. This is a burning question at the local level, so we will make sure to forward all of that to you and then share what you can answer back to our members. Also, there's been a very series of questions regarding getting clarity on the guidance of what information communities should release publicly regarding the number of people who have tested positive in their communities, and also a question about whether or not communities are getting access to the people who test positive who are in long-term care facilities or skilled nursing facilities located in their communities.
So thank you for that. So in terms of access to individuals who've tested positive, the DPH policy, and I believe this is from all levels of government, is that the addresses of confirmed positive cases are released through public safety agencies in each municipality, and so that information is available and should include those who are in long-term care or skilled nursing facilities as well, the addresses of those locations. In terms of what to release, I've seen communities take different approaches to this, and this isn't an issue that DPH takes on. You know, as you know, we release our case data on at the county level, and some communities have chosen to release case counts within the community, numbers who are quarantined in their community, but it's on a individual. Each jurisdiction can make that call according to their own needs and what they feel it best serves the interests of their community.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We'll now proceed with going through questions. I do know that there are a number of questions that have been asked regarding essential services. It does appear, based on what the Lieutenant Governor said, that you expect that there will be some further clarification, based on new federal updates, and that you will be providing that in real time to communities. One of the questions that continues to persist is, what if municipal officials who are in charge with enforcing the guidelines in the executive order are aware of situations where there's not social distancing and where it's not feasible for an operation to remain in business? What kind of guidance could you have for those communities? It could range from construction or landscaping, we've heard a lot on, but other areas where communities have significant concerns about whether or not it's feasible for social distancing to take place even in essential businesses. Elizabeth, I'll unmute you.
I can speak to this. So as I stated earlier, at 2:00, we will be making announcements regarding the time for the stay-at-home advisory and the essential services to be in order. So that's something that you should listen to. We also reviewed the federal government's essential services list and have made some changes to the essential services list, and that will be posted later today, and you should take a look at that. We also received, in the area of construction, a number of questions from municipal officials regarding both safety protocols and what those safety protocols should look like in order to protect the workers relative to social distancing, hand washing, sanitization, indoor work, outdoor work. And we provided more detail for you to take a look at there, as well as a question around resource for municipalities to have inspections to enforce these safety protocols. So we took all that into consideration, and we will be releasing information between today and tomorrow in the area of construction. In terms of the boards of health, you have a lot on your plates. We understand that, but you are empowered to look at the guidance from the state and do what you need to do to make sure that your community is safe and the places where essential services are being conducted or delivered are safe for the workers there. We may need to provide you with additional guidance or support. And if there is some instances where that might be needed, you can convey that either directly to our office if you feel it's an emergency and needs direct attention, or through Jeff, and we will take that into consideration.
Thank you, Governor. We understand it's 1:45 and you do have to depart. Thank you very much for that and for all of your work and answering these questions. We appreciate that. We will all be tuning in at 2:00, and thank you so much. We'll continue this session now as you depart. Thank you. Thank you. The next question for the panelists, we'll go through the chat function where we ask individuals to post questions. We'll get to as many of them as we can. If they do not get answered, we will record them and then send them on to the administration. Quick question about the general outlook for local aid for next year. I think that may be too early to tell, but also technically a question on April 20th and September 14th. Are they both holidays, or is April 20th no longer a state holiday?
I can answer that. They both are holidays.
Okay, thank you very much. So that's the, and what are you calling the September 14th, the marathon holiday, maybe?
There was no official designation from the legal side, so I will leave that to others to determine what to name. But yes, that's when the marathon will be taking place, and I can't speak to whether or not other Patriots Day celebrations will take place on that day.
Okay, thank you very much. The next question was regarding whether or not disinfection equipment would be eligible for reimbursement. I believe the answer to that is yes, unless Samantha Phillips says otherwise. The next question we have is regarding public health community volunteers, nurses to help the people need support. We do understand that there has been a call for volunteers and so on. Can someone speak to that a little bit? If not, we'll move on to the panelists. Just need to unmute themselves if they want to jump in on any of these questions. The next question, we believe that there is a website and a promotion to solicit volunteers, qualified public volunteers from the public health field, and we'll share that information with members. A question is, can public health nurses share the names and addresses of people who are in the community of people who need shelters? How do you actually connect people who the city is aware has a need, is that information possible to be shared with the shelters from the community? Can people, is there a violation of confidentiality?
This is Dr. Madoff. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand. Can the public health nurses share that information with who?
Well, with either with people who are obviously they can share the names of how to of the addresses of how to get in touch with the shelters. But what if individuals or people working for a community are aware of individuals who need help and should go to the shelter? Can the community share the shelter that? The information about these individuals with the shelter?
So I'm speaking just for me here, and that would seem like a privacy violation. I think the other way around, I think they can share the name of the shelter with the individual who needs services. And certainly the local Board of Health can reach out to shelters indicating that they have people in need, but I don't think that they should share names of sick individuals with shelters.
Okay, thank you. There's a question regarding the permit tolling provision. What's in the legislation would essentially put a freeze on permit application deadlines, constructive approval requirements, and so on until 45 days after the emergency. The MMA is working to get that impact implemented as soon as possible. The next question has to do with what is the chain of data for updating the number of positive cases? In other words, if a resident contacts the physician, a physician who says, based on your symptoms, you should assume that you have COVID-19, does this get shared with the Department of Public Health or the state agency tracking this, or is that information that is not included in these calculations?
Hi, thanks. Thanks for that question. I tried to type the answer to that question for that individual, but we are only able to capture laboratory information, laboratory confirmed cases. That is something that may change going forward, but at the moment we're only getting information through lab testing.
Thank you. This question is for Sean Cronin. Are you aware of any 9C cuts being considered for fiscal 20? And do you have any sort of prognostication or prediction regarding local aid adjustments for fiscal 2021?
As I said before, there's that meeting next week with the ANF secretary in both House and Senate Ways and Means, which I think will answer some, or at least start to answer some questions. So more to come after that. And like, while I got the mic, just two things. We will be blasting out something, as Kathy Marks mentioned, from DLS on the log me in opportunity. That will go out for my DLS alert this afternoon and this morning. We sent out something that Director Phillips had given us approval to do so, that gives you a link to MEMA's website that provides some of the information for municipalities, including how to account for these things so that you'll be able to get reimbursed. So if you haven't looked at those, well, at least one of them in your inbox, the other one will be coming out this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Sean. Here's a question about pay the patient, which is not prevalent throughout Massachusetts, but for EMS services, there's a concern that if there are pay the patient protocols by an insurer, that would put further stress on EMS services. Is there any comment at this time on that, or will we, is that something to look into for later? Okay, we'll bookmark that question. The concern about the loss of critical emergency management or public safety personnel if an entire shift decided they need to be self-quarantined. I think we've received some guidance and still looking for clarity regarding the idea of waiting for symptoms before self-quarantining takes place. Dr. Madoff said that there will be there are protocols for emergency medical personnel, and healthcare workers, but perhaps some further guidance and clarity, since there are so many questions on this, would be helpful. Let's see. Here's a question about how realistic it is for May 4th to be up running normal. I think we're going to get an answer to that question at 2:00 at the governor's and lieutenant governor's daily briefing. More concerns about local aid and an encouragement of using the state's stabilization fund so that cities and towns can maintain their services. And a shout out to Sean Cronin, who is very impressive, says this person on the chat. The next one is, can municipalities get an executive order from the governor to allow select boards to use free cash outside of town meeting below a certain threshold? Can you go over that again briefly in terms of giving communities access to resources in the legislation? Some power to be able to maintain services.
Okay. So a couple things. One, I think from a legal perspective, the answer is no. I don't think the governor can issue an executive order for that. But as I mentioned before, when the question came about stabilization fund, that's something that we're thinking about internally at DLS. We're doing our best both internally and reaching out to other conversations with some CFOs out there and some managers out there. You know, what issues do you see coming down? And I know the year-end process is something that will be here before we know it. So those are the types of things that we're focusing on now. And obviously those would be things that have never been done before. When you're talking about letting the executive branch of government become the legislative branch of government by approving appropriations. So, I mean, it's something that we know we have to think about, and we are thinking about internally, both for free cash and for stabilization fund. But also, remember, if this legislation goes through, there will be the ability to continue providing the core essential services in fiscal 21 through this so-called, you know, 1/12 minimum budget process that we at DLS will work with each of you that find yourself in that situation. So there will be some ability to continue to provide services in 21, but the question about using stabilization fund and or free cash for year-end fiscal 20 is something that we are thinking about internally.
Thank you very much. I will make a note that a number of our panelists have posted links in the chat function regarding access to information. We will be, the MMA will be placing all those on our website and include those in the summary briefing that we will post later on today on the website. So folks don't have to worry about copying those now. I do say that there's a final question. It has to do with paper bags versus single-use plastic bags. One local official has concerns that the reintroduction of plastic bags is more problematic, given that the virus may live longer on those plastic bags than on cardboard or brown paper bags. Is there any comment on that regarding the DPH's recent order? I guess not at this time. We will submit this to the administration for a
response. I'm sorry, I was muted. I don't have specific guidance on that. And, I think that the viability of the virus on plastic is of concern, but it's probably not the the most common way that this virus is spread, and that contact with surfaces is important, but that if people wash their hands after contact with surfaces, that does prevent transmission.
And we understand that DPH issued this order in order to avoid reusable bags at this time, which would potentially offer more of a threat to the workers in the grocery stores than the single use or paper bags.
I believe that was the concern, right?
So with only a couple minutes left, yes.
I think I saw a question earlier about the 960 hours from Mike Kennedy. It is included in both versions of the bill that's making its way through right now. So hopefully that becomes part of it and communities will be able to call back any type of municipal retiree to help out.
Thank you, Sean. We now have only 1 minute left, so I'll use this for some just quick announcements. I want to say thank you to the administration for this briefing and for all of the information. We will follow up and provide detailed answers as they become available. So we appreciate everyone's questions that have been submitted. In addition to that, we encourage you to go to the MMA.org website. And also to remember that this briefing will take place every Tuesday at 1 p.m. We will continue to take advantage of this. We have hundreds and hundreds of local officials on this call, and we want to thank all of you for being on the front lines, leading the effort in your communities to keep people safe, healthy, and to protect everyone to the best of your ability. You're doing heroes work, and we thank you very much. We will conclude this at this time and look forward to continuing our work with all of you during the coming week. Take care. Thank you very much.